today on Vox Talks Economics, why China's autocrats love the AI business and what that means for innovation. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. Now, Vox Talks Economics and also our companion podcast, Vox Dev Talks, I find I'm increasingly talking about China these days, and one aspect of China in particular, the dizzying growth of China's economy. It challenges our worldview that only liberal democracies can deliver sustained innovation and prosperity. China is certainly at the forefront of innovation in what's probably the most important general purpose technology of the 21st century, and that's artificial intelligence. So do China's leaders accelerate that innovation or do they impede it? Noam Yuchtman of the London School of Economics is one of a team that has attempted to answer this important question, and he joins me now. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Noam, why do we assume that autocratic societies like China always hold back domestic innovation?
So I think I would start, as economists love to do, with compelling theory. So in principle, a rational, forward-looking entrepreneur is just much less likely to innovate, knowing that the fruits of their efforts and capital and innovation could be confiscated at any time by an unconstrained autocrat. And working in another direction, autocrats themselves may directly restrict innovation, fearing that any sort of successful innovation or a successful innovator could undermine their position. So if you're in a position that's secure and happy, then you don't like disruption. Disruption is something you want to avoid at all costs. And finally, if we think about where the money-making opportunities are under autocracies, those opportunities often come from rent-seeking opportunities, the opportunity essentially to act in a corrupt way, to reallocate income and wealth that exists. And that means that if you have a lot of talent and you think to yourself, should I use that talent to do something innovative that requires a lot of work and may not have such high returns? Or should I select into working with a corrupt autocratic state? You might choose the latter, as scholars like André Schleifer have argued. Then there's the evidence. And I think the evidence begins with classic qualitative evidence, key examples where autocracies have really blundered in the course of the pursuit of innovation and economic change. Sometimes this is not about innovation per se, but just sort of missed opportunities to engage in economic activity. So you think about the story of Admiral Zheng He, the great Chinese explorer who went all the way to Africa and the Middle East in enormous boats that dwarfed Columbus's. And you think about the economic opportunity that might have come with continued exploration and trade expansion from China, and yet one autocratic emperor could choose to shut it down, and did. The czars famously restricted the expansion of the railroads. And then autocrats, just because of their enormous amount of political control, can just choose bad innovation policies. So you think about like Mao's Great Leap Forward, which led to famine that killed tens of millions of people. That was actually an attempt to encourage innovation. Khrushchev tried to develop a new form of agriculture for Siberia. It didn't work out. And autocrats are able to do these sorts of things in a sense because they aren't constrained and they can make these choices that often don't go well. As with anything quantitative and a question as broad as does democracy or autocracy affect economic growth? Of course, you know, the world is complicated. One variable doesn't explain everything. But the evidence seems to come in, as analyzed by people like Jim Robinson and Daron Acemoglu, in favor of democracy causing economic growth. And so all of this together, I think, makes economists feel like there is this preponderance of theory and empirics to push us in this direction. There's also just a more popular sense from what we've experienced for much of our lifetimes, I mean, at least those of us who aren't really young, that at some level, like, democracy won the ideological and economic war against autocracy. And so the fall of the Berlin Wall marked this moment when it seemed like the debate was settled. And Francis Fukuyama described that moment as signaling the end of history. And we just assumed that democracy was a preeminent system, not just for political rights, but also for economic vibrancy and success. And that's been eroded, I would say, in recent years by events in China and also experiences in the West.
But is there a counter argument as well? Is there a way in which these autocratic governments and innovators might complement each other?
Economists can always give you an on the one hand and on the other hand. So the other hand is that there are always innovations that can directly enhance the position of an incumbent autocrat. And you can think about this coming through different channels. And one is just prestige or legitimacy. So Sputnik being the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth, yes, was an incredible source of yeah, prestige and legitimacy for the Soviet Union. If you make a trip to Cuba, you're bombarded with all sorts of information about how successful their healthcare system is. Mm-hmm. And this is a source of pride and prestige and legitimacy for a dictatorship. So in some cases, you can think about technology and technological change not being destabilizing, but in fact being regime enhancing. Now, that's sort of on the ideological side. But of course, there's also the more coercive side. And you can think about coercive power being expressed in a couple ways. One is military power. And again, you can think about the Soviet Union developing some remarkably advanced military technologies, whether we're talking about fighter jets or nuclear weapons. You think about the German Empire of the late 19th century and early 20th century developing essentially a huge apparatus of modern science and producing tons of Nobel Prize winners in chemistry and physics. And the chemistry and physics Nobel Prize winners were part of a scientific structure that was all geared toward industrial power and military power for the imperial German state. So that use or the development of technology to use externally for military control, of course, will be something that an autocrat desires. An autocrat benefits from innovation in these areas directly. And then finally, there's internal control. And internal control, again, is something that autocrats crave and will enhance their positions of power. And some technologies will directly enhance that internal control. You think about like monitoring technologies of different kinds, and AI, of course, could be one of those.
Let's narrow down this sweep of history to what you studied, and that is AI, as you say, in China. What sort of application is the Chinese government using in 2021? What's it buying?
So in our work, we focus on facial recognition AI. Mm-hmm. And this is a big part of how AI is applied already in China. So you or any of the listeners who have made trips to China have encountered it immediately upon arriving at the airport.
Yes.
And then you'll see it also walking down the street. And so facial recognition AI technology, it is a big one. It's not a coincidence that we study it. It's also interesting how much of the development of AI in China has overlap with other areas where you can think about Western countries having many of the same interests in developing those applications. And so a big one is self-driving cars and the development of so-called smart cities. And because of China's ability to produce these enormous development projects, one of their types of development projects is a smart city that's developed from the ground up around the use of AI technology. And so a lot of AI development in those new smart cities, but also in existing cities to help to develop the technology to apply elsewhere, we see bundles of technology around the management of an urban area. So thinking about traffic management, which could go into self-driving cars, thinking about just tracking air pollution and other types of urban conditions, of course, monitoring technologies to try to prevent crime and also infrastructure to support consumer behavior. Some of these, I think, could also be seen in Western cities in the not too distant future, subject, I think, to some important privacy concerns that are much more likely to bind in the West. But I think what's interesting is that there are definitely some places of overlap. And I think, you know, like self-driving cars are the big one. And then there are some differences just in the extent of application. So we have CCTV everywhere in London, and you can imagine AI being applied to that for purposes of public security. And that would be in some ways similar to what's being done in China, although I think the difference in extent in China is currently enormous and may remain that way.
This is frontier technology, isn't it? Where is the Chinese government buying it from?
What's surprising to us, actually, is how broad a range of firms are providing AI services to the mm-hmm. Chinese government. So there are some enormous firms that are quite specialized in AI, firms like Megvii, that's a famous one that filed for an IPO, although it didn't go public yet, but some large specialized firms like that. And yet there are also many, many smaller firms. So it's still an emerging industry and smaller firms are trying to find their place. And when we look at the way that, China's AI ecosystem is developing, you might have thought that there would be kind of one dominant firm that had all the data, had the best technology, and it would partner with the Chinese government. It turns out that it's not that simple. And the reason for that is first that a lot of the decisions of how to contract and with whom to contract are decisions made locally. So the Chinese government isn't a single apparatus. It's not the case that the central government in Beijing is making most of the decisions, let alone deciding on the firms with which to contract. This stuff is decentralized. Local governments are making decisions of which firms to contract with. And then you can imagine different types of objectives that affect these local governments. So of course they want mm-hmm. good technology. And when we look at our data, we see that of the thousands of AI firms that are registered with the Chinese government, only about 15% get government contracts. So there's clearly selection of the better firms to get these types of contracts. They're firms that are better established and better capitalized and so on. But there still is a range of different firms that receive these contracts. And this opens up a window on like the more interesting aspects of the relationship between private firms and local governments, where local governments might want to encourage a particular firm for reasons of economic development. They might want to encourage a particular firm because that firm is desperate for government data, which is so valuable for developing AI technology. So those firms might offer to do a job very cheaply, knowing that the firm is also getting data as a form of compensation. In some cases, the local government might decide to contract with a particular firm for private reasons, we can say, for example, due to some personal connection between the local official and the entrepreneur. It's an interesting ecosystem, but we have many hundreds of firms that are receiving these AI contracts. And so the spillover benefits from the Chinese government's contracting with firms are going to a large ecosystem of firms, actually.
As you say, China's use of facial recognition technology, which is what you study in this paper, is very advanced. And I think you've investigated how effective it is at controlling political protest in China. Is there evidence that the government organizations that are employing AI for this purpose, they're getting a good return on their investment?
Yeah. In fact, we think we are able to provide compelling evidence that facial recognition AI does have an impact on local political unrest mm-hmm. and that governments are contracting with AI firms specifically aiming at that purpose of controlling unrest. So taking a step back, you might wonder, first, to what extent is the use of facial recognition AI largely political, or could it be more oriented toward public security? You know, it wasn't 100% clear to us that we would see major effects. And, you know, in addition, sort of some qualitative evidence by political scientists who have studied and computer scientists who have studied AI in China suggested that although it's clear that China is working toward developing AI for political means, it's not obvious that AI is so good yet. And so that was the open question that we had. One, is most of the AI purchased in response to political unrest, or some of it purchased in a causal way in response to political unrest? And two, when it's purchased, does it actually reduce unrest? And so we divide our empirical analysis really into those two parts. So we start by looking at what happens following political unrest events in a locality in China. And we get these political unrest events from a database called the GDELT data. So the GDELT mm-hmm. database sort of scrapes all sorts of news sources, collects information on different types of events around the world. We focus on events like protests and petitions and things like that that mark out political unrest within China by locality and by time period. And what we find is that immediately after one of these political unrest events in the GDELT data, locally we see a spike in the public security agencies in that locality issuing facial recognition AI contracts, which to us was a first indication that these local police forces are responding to unrest.
Yes.
Now, we still, as empirical economists, have to prepare ourselves for all sorts of questions about what else might be going on. And they're important questions. So what else might be going on? Well, it might be the case that places with political unrest are just experiencing much more social and economic change And what we see in terms of the procurement of facial recognition AI, it might be part of a general modernization experience that's happening. So we explore that in a couple ways. So first, we can see whether there's more of this facial recognition AI procurement by the police forces prior to the unrest. And we don't see any evidence of that. The next thing we do is we can check whether procurement of AI following episodes of political unrest occurs outside of the local public security agency. So is it the case that like the local schools and hospitals and banks, which also procure a lot of AI in China, believe it or not, are they also procuring AI around this time, or is it specific to the police forces? And in fact, it is specific to the police forces. We also see some other interesting complementary evidence. When these local police forces respond to local political unrest, they do so by procuring more facial recognition AI. They also do so by procuring more high-resolution surveillance cameras. Mm-hmm. And so it really looks like this is a concerted effort to develop a new mode of monitoring and controlling the population. It seems like the local public security agencies are responding to unrest using AI as one of the inputs in a new technology of political control. The second part is whether it works. Empirically, this is a challenging question to answer because when you have political unrest leading to AI procurement and political unrest typically also being serially correlated, meaning over time, some political unrest today is associated with political unrest tomorrow and the day after, suddenly it becomes very hard to tease out the causal role of the new AI technology that was procured. And so instead of kind of flipping our empirical analysis from the first part, which would have all of these problems of interpretation, what we do instead is we say, well, let's think about what types of external shocks to a locality might tend to produce political unrest in that locality. And now let's ask the question of whether past AI procurement, before these shocks, I'll describe what those are in just a minute, but is it the case that past AI procurement acts in a sense to like inoculate a locality against these types of events that would typically, in the absence of the AI, precipitate local unrest? And so we think about two types of these external shocks or events that can tend to precipitate local unrest. One is a very simple one, which has been used in the past in the economics literature as a driver of local protests, and that is the weather. It's not a major political driver, but it happens to be a significant political driver. Better or worse weather on a given day will have some bearing on whether a political unrest event happens on that day in the locality experiencing that weather. So imagine that you're in a region of China where a local official, let's say, is revealed to be corrupt. Then throughout that region, there might be political unrest on a given day. But in those places within that region, let's say that have a torrential rainstorm or something like that, the unrest is much less likely. In that same region, if you happen by chance to have better weather, unrest is more likely. So exploiting that sort of variation, what we find is better weather tends to produce unrest, but if a locality had previously procured more AI, the impact of the good weather on unrest is mitigated. We also do a similar sort of analysis thinking about unrest in nearby localities. So more unrest in nearby localities tends to drive unrest in your own locality, but that relationship is weakened if a locality had previously procured AI. So it does seem like there is this sort of inoculation effect of past AI procurement that reduces the threat of local political unrest.
So now let's think about it from the other end. Were you able to establish that this good stream of business for the firms providing the AI, the government contracts, is making them more innovative?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we find. And it's a good way to put it in the sense that we're able to study the effects of these government contracts on firms. And I think that's an important starting point. I'll get to what it means for the macroeconomy in a minute, but let's just first talk about the evidence that we find for the firms themselves. We study contracts that we think are specifically politically motivated. So we look at a locality, we ask, did that locality experience relatively high levels of political unrest in a given quarter of the year? And we'll code public security agencies' procurement of AI contracts in the following quarter as politically motivated if the previous quarter had had high levels of political unrest. And then we're able to study what happens to new software products developed by a firm around the time that it receives a politically motivated contract. And what we find is that relative to a comparison group of firms, firms that will receive one of these politically motivated contracts aren't doing anything really different prior to receiving the contract, but immediately after receiving the contract, they start to diverge. They start to produce more software. They start to produce more software, not just for the government, but more broadly, they produce more commercial software, which suggests to us that receiving a politically motivated contract is able to actually move out the broader technological frontier that these firms are pushing out. What does this mean at the macro level? And because we can't explore every possible mechanism that might affect firms in the macro economy, there are different types of spillovers, there are different types of effects that the government will have on firms. But in an earlier working paper, we explored different types of assumptions regarding the effects of firms' access to government data and what it means for overall innovation, both sort of in its direction and its level. And we find under some reasonable assumptions that access to government data actually can both stimulate AI innovation and stimulate innovation overall, driving economic growth.
But does this distort innovation as well? As you said at the beginning, that one of the problems of being an innovator in autocracy is you have to please whoever's in charge. So I would imagine that there was a temptation to provide sort of software for autocrats, repression as a service. Is that happening?
That's a subtle question. And of course, you can see I love to answer questions as if they're posed in multiple ways. And so let me start by saying an aspect of innovation that we examined but don't find much evidence of distortion is within the category of facial recognition AI. Let me back up and say we know a reasonable amount about the type of software these AI firms are producing. So new software products in China have to be registered with the government, which is what allows us to use machine learning to code whether a new product is oriented toward government use or commercial use, which I mentioned before. We're also able to use AI to code whether the facial recognition software seems to be more oriented for surveillance purposes versus other purposes of facial recognition AI. And that's a subtle distinction as well. But you can imagine that some AI products, facial recognition AI products, are described much more about identification, predicting, let's say, consumers' tastes, which is a big application area in China, where consumers going to a grocery store, let's say, will be identified, and that allows firms to tailor product offers to that consumer. But other types of facial recognition AI products are much more oriented for surveillance. And this is true certainly for government software. It's also even true for commercial software, where you can imagine firms producing software products that are oriented, for example, toward tracking and retrieving, let's say, a lost child, which I might want myself, actually, having a little kiddo who can run around. But this type of surveillance AI, even for private consumers, is something that we wondered, do you see much more of that arising from these politically motivated contracts that were clearly aimed at surveillance and close monitoring of individuals in the first place? And so we track whether these firms, upon receipt of one of these politically motivated contracts, end up producing much more surveillance-oriented commercial software than firms receiving less politically motivated contracts. We don't see evidence of that, actually. Nor do we see evidence that politically motivated contracts lead to less commercial software than non-politically motivated contracts, which you might have thought if there was some sort of crowding out. And so, you know, at some high level, you think perhaps there isn't that much distortion coming out of these politically motivated contracts. But there's a different angle on the question that you asked, which is, well, might facial recognition AI software in general be a technology area that is particularly helpful for autocrats? And I think the answer is quite plausibly yes. And we search for evidence of that actually in some analyses that aren't in the paper, the AItocracy paper, but that we hope will appear in some future work. And so I'll tell you what we've dug into, which is trade patterns in AI. And what you see in the trade data is that the Chinese exports of AI are much more likely to go to autocrats, much more likely to go to sort of unstable and weak democracies compared to other major AI exporters. So the US, for example, doesn't export such a large share of its AI to other autocrats. And also, you know, when we see the pattern of trade, you know, from China to these autocrats in AI, it's not because China generically exports to other autocrats. When you look even at other frontier technologies like solar panels, where China is really at the technological frontier, China doesn't export its solar panels disproportionately to autocrats and leaders of weak democracies. China's just exporting its AI disproportionately to autocrats and weak democracies. And so this is preliminary evidence, I should say, but it does suggest that even if the within facial recognition distortion doesn't appear in our data, the fact that China is able to produce so much facial recognition technology, presumably driven to some extent by the enormous amounts of surveillance data available in China, that does seem to be leading to the development of something like software for autocrats. And it seems like autocrats around the world are actually happily buying it.
There'll be a lot of people listening to this who have a very strong emotional reaction to the sort of things we're talking about. We instinctively recoil, those of us who grow up in a different environment, from this kind of close monitoring and control. Is the research that you're doing here about the impact on innovation, it's good for innovation, or are we making any conclusion about whether this is good for the Chinese people or whether it's good for the world in general?
Our current work reflects the usual approach by economists, which is to write positive rather than normative papers. And the purpose of the AItocracy paper is just to document this possibility of a mutually reinforcing relationship between autocratic political motives and AI innovation in China. It is obviously important for us as people and social scientists specifically to think about what the normative implications are of the positive analysis that we conducted. And one thing we do state in the paper and in our other work on AI is that benefits observed in terms of innovation or economic growth, we usually think about these as good things, may not be welfare improving. Mm-hmm. In our current paper, where we focus specifically on China, we note that these improvements in AI innovation may not be beneficial to China's population to the extent that these types of innovation outcomes are offset by reductions in privacy, reductions in civil liberties. Of course, these are to be taken extremely seriously. I want to be clear that the traditional view of economics that innovation is a good thing and that anything that leads to higher economic growth might be viewed as a good thing, that's simply not correct. There are other things that go into well-being beyond innovation and economic growth. And in China, in some cases, it's clear that the offsets are large. I mentioned some of our preliminary work thinking about trade in AI. And, you know, trade is an area of economics and public policy where we think about international regulation that arises from certain normative concerns. And I think one very obvious and natural analogy between AI and other types of normative restrictions on trade is to compare AI and specifically the upstream collection of data to the upstream labor inputs in the global supply chain. So if you think about upstream labor in whether it's mining, whether it's the production of textiles, you know, throughout the world, we're concerned about the ethical structures within which that upstream input is applied. Data is an upstream input in the global supply chain for more and more technology, particularly AI technology. And if we think about different ethical standards applied to the upstream collection of data, we may want to restrict the upstream collection of data, just as we restrict the upstream exploitation of labor in the global supply chain. Another normative dimension that comes out of trade in particular is the possibility that China may be enhancing autocrats around the world by exporting software for autocrats. In the case that we're concerned about these types of political spillovers and changes in political regimes internationally, one can imagine a group of countries or a group of institutions trying to implement regulations on the export of AI, just as we restrict the export of other types of technologies, oftentimes military technologies, that we're concerned will enhance the power of autocrats over their citizens. So some of these justifications, I think, will be explored in our future work, but I think they are incredibly important.
Is this AItocracy, that's the name of the paper, this relationship, this complementarity between autocrats and the leading edge technology providers, is this a one-off or has it happened before?
There are some experiences in the past that do share characteristics with the current mutual reinforcement of innovation and autocracy in China. So I think the experience of the USSR with aerospace. If we think again about Imperial Germany and sort of the strengthening of its military alongside the strength of its industry and science, those were experiences lasting decades in which, you know, an innovative or science frontier was being pushed out as an autocracy was entrenching itself. So I don't think that that type of relationship is unique to AI-tocracy, but I think that AI does have some special features that may make it different. And for those of us who instinctively recoil from a society with enormous control allocated to an autocrat, you know, supported by technology, I think it leads to more fear, in fact. And I think one dimension of this is that AI really is a potentially general purpose technology. And so we're not just talking about a society where a small group of technologies, maybe, you know, linked to aerospace or something like that in the USSR, as important as those could have been also for the military. But it wasn't the case that the entire technological frontier in the USSR was pushed out because of the relationship between the autocracy and the innovators. It was a small part then. Now it might be a much, much bigger part. In addition, I think I worry that AI, and not just me, but others as well, that autocracy might be a particularly conducive political system for AI. Mm-hmm. So space innovation wasn't something that just benefited much more from having an autocrat in charge. So the Democratic United States was just as good at mobilizing resources to push out its innovation to achieve ultimate success, in fact, in the space race. But AI innovation is so dependent on data. And autocrats are so involved historically and especially today in the collection of data. Second, AI depends on the sharing of data with firms. And autocrats are so much less constrained than democracies in the sharing of data. And so we have these constraints on democracy, the need to respect human rights and civil liberties that might actually give autocracy an underlying advantage in the production of AI technology, whereas in other technological areas, it wasn't so clear that autocracy was much better for them. And I do worry that AI could actually be different in ways that make AI-tocracy more durable and that enhance autocracy and actually encourage innovation more than in the mutually reinforcing relationships of the past.
The assumptions that eventually autocracies would collapse under the weight of their own obsolescence might not be true anymore.
Yeah, I think we need to take very seriously this possibility that innovation and autocracy will continue hand in hand in China, in Russia as well, potentially. And we need to take that into account when thinking about a range of different public policies, both domestic innovation policies and perhaps international trade policies. I think that there could be a major threat for the first time to the West's leadership in an important technological area. And that's something that will become relevant both for the wealth of nations in thinking about commercial applications of AI and the power of nations thinking about the military applications of AI. So I think it requires serious, serious consideration of that initial assumption that you mentioned. We need to be open to the possibility of sustained innovation under autocracy. I will say, I don't think this is inevitable. So I think we also shouldn't be too alarmist. There are many things going in our favor, even in the AI space, in the innovation space. So China does face the traditional challenges that autocracies face. The autocrat in China does fear the rise of new challengers. Xi Jinping is aggressively imprisoning people, accusing them of corruption, making entrepreneurs disappear. And that's in some ways a reflection of his strength and the lack of constraints, but of course also a sign of his weakness. The strength of democratic institutions goes beyond individuals, and the Chinese regime has moved more toward a set of institutions that depend on an individual, and that generates threats to stability. Any sort of leadership transition in China has become much more uncertain since Xi Jinping changed what was an informal, if not formal, sort of rule within the Chinese Communist Party that the head of the party would have two terms and then resign. So there remains uncertainty. In addition, entrepreneurs often like civil liberties. Entrepreneurs like to have many of the benefits that come from living in more open, freer societies. And to the extent that human talent matters for AI innovation, in addition to having access to a lot of data, and it's clear that human talent matters a lot, then this is something where the West still has a big advantage. And we have that advantage also in attracting Chinese graduate students, Chinese entrepreneurs. And I think that one of the big public policy tensions that comes out of research like this that my co-authors and I have produced is the right response by the West to shut down intellectual exchange with China, especially in these high-tech areas. And I just want to say that's far from clear. It may very well be that exactly our major advantage in the West is having institutions, having a way of life that China's best and brightest continue to value. They continue to come to our best universities, and they continue to often stay and form businesses and patent to all of our benefit in the West.
But no, I've interviewed a lot of tech entrepreneurs over the years, and it's fair to say that many instinctively believe in technologies like AI as a force for good, as giving power to the powerless, democratizing society. This appears to be a pretty fatal blow to that assumption, doesn't it?
It's one more blow. So I think traditionally, economists thought technology could be modeled essentially as a pure good. It just enhanced productivity. And that's what we worried about. We thought about production functions, and higher productivity was good. What could be bad about higher productivity? Then economists began to think about distributional consequences. So people like Larry Katz and David Autor began to realize that there could be losers from technological change as well as winners. And even if technology made society as a whole more productive, there typically wasn't the sort of redistribution to the losers that would make everybody better off. Political economists have now begun to see technology similarly, that it has, of course, potential to improve outcomes also in the political space, empowering voters by allowing for better monitoring of elections, for example, giving voters more access to information rather than less. So there are these possibilities, but whether it's more access to distorted information, as some people have feared coming from social media, or a range of concerns about AI that led Doron Acemoglu to write a handbook chapter just called Harms of AI, I think economists have begun to see that the technology is not simply inherently good, certainly not for everyone. The normative consequences are just much more subtle and depend on the complementary economic and political and social institutions in which the technologies are developed and applied.
I'm going to be following your research from now on, though, but thank you very much for talking about it today.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Wasn't that great? If you want to read more about it, I bet you do, then the paper is called AI-tocracy, as we mentioned. It is discussion paper 16703 at TEPR, and the authors are Martin Baraha, Andrew Cao, David Yang, and Noam Jugdman. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week, we bring you the most important latest research. So if you want to know what you're going to be reading in journals 18 months from now, well, listen to Vox Talks Economics today. And when you subscribe, you'll find almost 200 episodes of whatever type of economics you like. There's already a Vox Talk waiting for you.